It's all about communication, because when talent is so scarce, you can't take the risk. Employer branding and communication in the recruitment process was something that companies were thinking about before 2019. Now companies, they have to really adapt that process to a global one. You really need to think, you know, it's your market entry. And I think you really have to be conscious of that, that you don't seem like, I don't know, you don't seem like a new Roman.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Speak Like a CEO. My name's Lena Carlson, and I'm here with Oliver Oust. Hey, Oliver.
Hey, Lena. Our guest today is Jonathan Romley. He built successful businesses on three continents, certainly not something many people can say. His last company was sold to Google, and he's today the co-founder and CEO of Lundy, a borderless talent acquisition platform that helps companies recruit globally. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, Oliver. Hey, Lena.
How are you doing today, Jonathan?
You know, every day is a little bit better. So today's a good day.
Absolutely. Where are you today?
I'm in Warsaw. I'm in Poland.
And then I think leads to my first question. I mean, you build successful businesses on three continents. I think it's worth dwelling on that fact for a little while. So where were these businesses and how did you do that?
So I've built businesses in Ukraine, also here in Poland, in China, in the US. So kind of in Europe, in Asia. And in North America, how did that get started? Well, I'm from California, so I think that a common question wherever I am anywhere in the world when I'm not in California is, what are you doing in our country and why are you not in California? I hear this a lot. Like, why would you leave the beach and the nature and the business and Silicon Valley and this environment and Hollywood and whatever it was? Well, I can say that I'm from Los Angeles. There are reasons for leaving Los Angeles. It has a tech community, but that's not primarily what Los Angeles is about. So it was logical to move up to San Francisco, but I think that I understood pretty quickly there that there are just really a lot of smart people, which is a good thing. You want to be in a place as an entrepreneur where all the smart people are, right? It's like going to Hollywood if you're an actor. So, okay, I'm here. This is the big show. Everything is happening. Isn't that fantastic? One of the challenges about that, though, is that smart people are almost commoditized in that environment. You're an experienced founder, or you've got a great idea for a product that you want to build, whatever it is, there are like 1,000 more people like you. That's an environment to be in for the best companies. But I think that one thing that happens in that place, a lot of times you end up with this kind of tunnel vision of really first world challenges and first world problems. And those are interesting and they lead to products that the whole world uses. But I think that there are a lot of interesting challenges all over the world. And for me, I like to solve them, probably because I like to travel. So that's probably what led me out. But what's interesting about those places is that often people are so focused on getting out of where they are. That's one thing, right? So I'm in this place and I need to emigrate. I should go somewhere else because this country where I'm in, there's a limited opportunity for me to be successful. So that's something that people think. And people that are great innovators leave countries that could otherwise be building great companies and solving problems there. And I think that's actually what brought me to Ukraine. Right. So the idea that having been at a company that was successful enough in Silicon Valley that had started out of a university in Ukraine, what I understood pretty quickly is that what we had done, it didn't really matter. And that if I wanted to have the best talent, that I probably wasn't going to get it in the Bay Area, not because it's not there, okay? Like, the smartest people in the world, they're there. They're really there. Very, very smart people. But as an employer, right? Because I'm an employer at the end of the day. As an entrepreneur, you build a company, you're an employer, you employ people, and you need to recruit talent. As an employer, whew, that is a tough market. That is a very tough market. and companies, you know, they have trouble to hire. So even 8 years ago, when I've taken the jump and moved to Ukraine, I thought, well, the reason that I'm doing this is, one, I have a lot more runway with the capital that I have, a lot more runway. And two, I can access people in this market that probably I wouldn't be their first choice employer if they were in San Francisco or if they were in the Bay Area, right? And that's kind of how this whole thing got started, which is this idea of, let's go to a market where what we did means something and it resonates within the community, right? So there was a really good data point. It was like at the time, that exit was the data point for foreign direct investment into technology in Ukraine outside of the outsourcing business. Much more successful, much bigger deals have happened since then and in companies that were actually founded by Ukrainians. So that's great. Super fantastic. But at the time it was a data point, right? So that's why I went and I thought, okay, I'm going to build something. I don't know what I'm going to build. I'm going
to
build something.
So basically at Silicon Valley, you have to compete as an employer with Google and Facebook and all the other great companies there, which is obviously tough. So you went to Ukraine to find the best developers to do what exactly at Lundy?
You know, it wasn't only about developers. And I think this is something that people associate certain parts of the world with, right? If we drew a map of the world, it would be possible to say, okay, well, developers come from Ukraine and business process outsourcing, call centers, technical support, it comes from the Philippines. You could map out things like this. But the truth is there are great people everywhere. I think that the reason that I went to Ukraine, first off, of course, it was initially about engineers. It was definitely about engineering talent. It was about research talent. And it was actually about finding these PhD thesis level university professors and students that would work on solving problems. And actually, I didn't go really with an idea. I just said, okay, so I'm going to find some really smart people and we're going to work on a problem for 3 months. We're just going to, I'll come up with a problem, or maybe we'll come up with a problem as a team as time goes on, and we'll try to solve that problem, whatever that problem is. The first problem we tried to solve was, of course, with technology, was to try to identify, and this is super abstract, right? It was to try to identify what characteristics of an image influence purchase intent. We had some idea, like if we did that, we could create a product that was like a make awesome button for e-commerce that a retailer, that an e-commerce merchant could use to kind of run like a filter across all of their products. And that filter would influence the conversion on their site. So after about 3 months, we identified two things that influence purchase intent. Human present, white background. That was it. So not a business, actually.
That's the make awesome button for e-commerce.
Yes, make awesome button. Put a human in it and have a white background and you increase your conversion. So free advice. But imagine if I had made such a three-month experiment with five master's thesis or PhD level researchers in California. There, the answer, human present, white background, you know, we had a laugh and went, oh, okay, so let's just do something else. You know, from another perspective, if I had done that in California at the time, much more resource intensive, but also I don't know that I would have found five guys and gals that would be like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go do that for 3 months and see what happens. So I think that was what it was all about. It was about resource availability in the beginning, not just in technology talent, but across the board.
Super interesting process that you're talking about there. Just to backtrack a little bit, what is your background or your skills, or where are you coming from when you enter the world of entrepreneurship? Are you also a developer yourself?
I am. So I'm your technical co-founder.
The ideal CTO.
if you had to categorize me, I'm a technical co-founder. You know, someone told me once that I should never tell anybody that. And that I should always be the CEO and I should never admit that I know how to write code.
I mean, It's a very in-demand position as CTO, I would say, but also being able to combine it with a CEO role is quite unique, I would say, to have this technical and business expertise. How did you kind of come onto that path of merging the two?
Well, I think that, not to date myself, but so much of this, when I was a child, when I was a young person, so much of everything that's happening now was happening around me. I've been to primary school on the campus of UCLA. We were one of the first schools in the country, in the United States, to have high-speed internet access. So much of this was environment. Of course, not everybody that was around me is doing the same thing, that's for sure. But having access to this at such a young age, I think really shaped my interests, my plans. So I think that was something like from a technical perspective, that's something that was always interesting for me and has been forever. But of course, I understood and had a desire also to build a business, right? I'm from a family of entrepreneurs. So both of my parents had businesses, and I saw that they were not technology businesses. They were in the entertainment business, of course, because I'm from Los Angeles. But I saw that and said, okay, well, I know that I want to be in tech, and I know that I can build something. You look up to your parents, you think, okay, so I want to be like that. I want to run a business. I want to be in charge, which is like, that's only the tip of how that begins. Oh, I want to be in charge. Ooh, famous last words. Okay.
But it worked out pretty well for you, I'd say. I mean, one of your companies where you were one of the co-founders, I believe, was sold to Google. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. So that's a company that I didn't found. The company started in Ukraine and commercialized technology out of the National Technical University in Kyiv. That company raised money. That company got venture capital eventually from some VCs in the US. And the founders found themselves no longer the management of the company. Oof, it happens. So I came into that really in the last stage of the business, which was, hey, can you come up here and I'm going to make this sound super simple, right? Hey, can you come up here? It's a Saturday. Can you come on a Monday? We need some help with product. And by the way, because we're selling the company, you're going to be here for 3 months. The company will be acquired the day after tomorrow. 2 years later, two years later, the company was eventually sold. And in this case, yes, to Motorola Mobility, which at the time was owned by Google. So, I mean, full disclosure, everything there, right? My role in that company was focused initially on products, and then on business development and developer evangelism. So that was my role. We were building face recognition technology, which you can find pretty much everywhere now. And there were several companies doing the same thing. One was acquired by Facebook. We were acquired by Google, Google Inc. in the end. And so the story there, again, though, was one where my role was focused on engaging with partners and other members of the development community to find commercial use cases for the software, for the SDK, right? To find commercial use cases for the technology that we had developed, which was really exciting, right? So you've got face recognition technology, and my mandate was to identify how we can put that to work. So I really had a great opportunity to engage with everything from financial services to defense to all kinds of use cases for this technology. And in the end, I think that was something where many companies that build core tech or deep tech tend to struggle a little bit, which is in this commercialization. So they raise a lot of money, sounds super cool, great demos, looks very, very Hollywood, very flashy, very awesome, super great. Believe me, we had really nice commercials that we used for what I don't know. But identifying where is really the commercial business there was a challenge. And I think if that company had identified, if we had more commercial use cases, so the company would sell for more money. When I have started this lab in Kyiv, this is actually what we set out to do, which is why we were using computer vision and machine learning and artificial intelligence to try to do things that directly impacted revenue. Because face recognition, it's hard to imagine how you're going to make money with it. You can come up with lots of ways. What I set out to do in the lab in Kyiv was identify how can we use technology like this to make money. And I think that we're doing the same thing now in Lundy, right? Which is, how can we use AI, how can we use machine learning to do something that directly impacts your business so that there's real measurable value?
Now that you've brought it up, what exactly is Lundy for our listeners?
Lundy is a borderless talent platform. So what does that mean? Let's imagine that you're an employer. So you're an employer, you need to hire people, right? And you have two problems. So the first one is you need to hire people, and the second one is you need to hire people that hire people. This is a really common problem in the world right now. It sounds kind of unbelievable even that with everything that's happened in the last 18 months that it could be difficult to hire people. We hear in the media so many people have lost their jobs, so many people are out of work. And then we hear from employers, well, I want to hire people. I would like to find people to work in my business, but I can't find them. And the two things, they don't really match up, right? This is the skills gap. And it's really, really, really coming out now that yes, all those people that were out of work, well, they don't exactly necessarily match the skills that employers need, right? So companies start to look remotely. How we started at Lundy, we started as a platform that helped companies that wanted to make recruitment of people in a country where they didn't have an home base or an office or relationships. We started as a platform that gave companies access to those markets, to local recruiters in those markets. We were kind of born in COVID, right? So just at the end of 2019. And I think that our use case evolved quite a bit. We always set out to build a network of recruiters, a global network of recruiters. Lots of story behind that, but we set out to build this global network of recruiters. And that's really what we are. So Lundy's a global network of recruiters. How you use those recruiters, two ways. One way, of course, if I'm an employer, it's the way that I've described. I'm an employer in Germany, and I would like to hire someone to work in the UK. So I can use Lundy to hire somebody in the UK to access local recruiters and agencies in the UK with one relationship. So I don't have to go and find vendors and interview recruiters. We use a matching technology that analyzes your job description and matches the best recruiter to actually go out and make that recruitment. So this is the core of what we do. How we're addressing remote is first identifying not only who is the best recruiter to do the job, but like where can you find this talent? This is the biggest challenge that companies face now with hiring anywhere. Anywhere is not a real place. You have to choose a place where you are going to hire people from. So often companies are putting remote. They check the remote checkbox. We're hiring remotely. This is not a targeted way to hire and doesn't really match the way that companies do hiring in the first place, right? So if they were hiring, they would always be doing outbound search, not just, well, let's put it up and see what happens. So what we're doing in response to changes in the market is using our matching technology to identify where are those top 3 to 5 markets that you can find talent, where talent is actually available. So what we do, we connect into your applicant tracking system. This is the place, it's like the CRM for hiring, if you're not familiar. Place where you have all your jobs and your candidates and you manage the process. We connect in there and we take out all the jobs and we analyze those jobs and we identify where you can find talent for those positions. Where in the world can you find talent? And we present that back to you. So here is a financial analyst position that you're hiring for in London. Well, you could find a financial analyst with equal qualifications, equal language, willing to work on the same time schedule, you know, in 4 or 5 other countries. Would you like to do that? And if you would like to do that, then you're right into our global recruiter network that sources the talent, that pre-screens them, and puts them back into your ATS. That's what we do. We basically help people hire anywhere, but more specifically to identify where there are opportunities to source talent and then to help you actually go get that talent into your company.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems that the companies that will thrive in the 2020s were the companies that can find talent globally, because as I said, there's a skills shortage going on and immigration doesn't scale, right? So it's very hard to bring people at scale into a country these days. And that's probably why companies like Spotify, Twitter, and many others could be described as sort of leading organizations in this field, hiring anywhere now. So basically, you make this process possible. Is that right?
That's correct. We make it possible at Lundy for a company that wants to take this journey or that is already open to hiring anywhere. We make it possible to identify exactly where that anywhere is and to then source that talent and bring them into your organization.
Cool. I'd really like to talk about something that we've kind of touched upon this entire conversation, is the tech talent issue, which I think in one way or another you can solve short term by, you know, setting yourself up in places like Ukraine, where there actually is a higher volume of developers right now, or Poland, for example, compared to, say, like Germany or potentially the States, where it's more competitive right now. But I think it's a broader issue, right? I think it really starts with education and getting more people interested into STEM and showing them these use cases early on for the power of what technology can do, such as machine learning and AI, which are for a lot of people skills that they didn't get to learn when they were younger. Do you have kind of a take on this or a view on this in terms of how we can actually get more people interested in this field at the very beginning?
This is a problem that countries like the US and Germany and the UK have been aware of for a long time, that without being political about it, you know, the US not exactly scoring in the top math scores in the world, right? So this is a challenge that starts so early on that it's difficult to imagine how that can change very quickly. I think that this problem is a very big ship and it's going to be very, 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 very slow to turn it. Of course, there is a focus globally in the markets where there is a shortage of STEM talent. But I think once you already have a shortage of this talent, you're 20 years away from solving the problem. Maybe 10 years away. 10, 20 years away from solving the problem, and new problems will spring up along the way. So much of this ties back to solutions that have to be legislated, school curriculums, funding for such programs tends to come from state and federal governments. And if you're looking to the government generally anywhere for a solution, probably a commercial solution will arrive before a federal one. I can think of one company in the US that a colleague has founded. I think it's called Kenzie Academy, K-E-N-Z-I-E. And they have a pretty interesting model, which I believe involves reskilling and upskilling people that are already in the workforce into technology positions. And I have a feeling that they probably take a percentage of the salary, or they get paid based on future success. Not sure. I think it's something like this, but I know that they're quite successful with it in reskilling and upskilling people. This is probably the only solution in the near term. And again, that's a commercial solution, right? So they've built a business around that, even if it is a business which has a social impact. It is definitely a business at the end of the day. And I think that's probably, you know, look, commercial solution is fine to this problem. That's the kind of thing that you'll see. Upskilling, reskilling. There is a surplus of workforce in some categories. The opportunity in the near term for those categories would be to reskill and upskill. I think that's going to happen through entrepreneurship, actually, through business, and probably not through the education system.
That's super interesting. And I agree that there are quicker commercial solutions. We have similar businesses here in Berlin as well. And I was wondering that if a CEO of a growing company would come to you, and this probably happens on a daily basis now, but ask you, okay, Jonathan, what should I do? I can't find the talent here. Not just from you already touched on the technical and the organizational part of this, but from a communications perspective, how do I need to change my employer branding or how I talk to potential talent I want to bring into the organization if I'm not recruiting in my home market, but somewhere else in the world?
That's a great question. I think that so often, and I'm guilty of this myself, so this is through trial and error that I've learned this. It's not because I've known it the whole time. When I've been in Ukraine, and also we had the same challenge in China, and I've had the same challenge in Poland, I've wanted to hire for some position. For example, sales development representative in Poland. And I've given the job title, sales development representative, and I've copy-pasted some job description probably from Salesforce because they have a great sales program there. And their SDR, okay, fine, let's take that description and put it and send it to a recruitment agency that shall remain nameless. And have said, okay, look, this is what I want in my business. I'm looking for an SDR. Actually, I probably also need a few SDRs, an SDR manager, some business development associate. But anyway, the position is SDR.
What's SDR?
Right, exactly. That was the first question from the recruiter. So I've explained a sales development representative is like an outbound cold caller to make it nice and simple. But even when I explained it in this way, still didn't get it. Like, because I said call. So now they're thinking, oh, so it's like is it a call center? You're going to give them leads? It was really a challenge. And because of this communication issue where the recruiter did not understand what it was, who it was that I wanted to hire, what was the profile of the job? Even though I at the time I thought like I could not explain this more clearly. Here are 10 links to other people hiring for the same positions. Of course, nobody in Poland, but hiring for the same positions all over the world. I don't understand the talent I'm receiving because I was receiving like board member level talent. And I was looking for, this is an entry level position, which is very labor intensive and involves, you know, sending a lot of messages to people. Let's just leave it at that. I don't think it's somebody 20 years into their career that was most previously the director of sales for a multinational. This is, you know, this is a job for, of course, anybody that's ready to do the job, but probably a job for somebody that's a little bit earlier in their career than that. So just to give you this example, we never closed that hire. We never closed it, and it totally failed. And it failed because we didn't localize the job offer, meaning that I've failed as a hiring manager to actually localize, meaning to use the description, the job title and description of such a position that matches something that people understand on the market, at least the recruiter. Because if the recruiter doesn't understand what they're supposed to be recruiting for, you are not going to close that hire. It's going to be a mess. And if you copy paste this into five countries, you're just going to have a really big mess of a bunch of talent that you're not going to hire. And so this was something that happens everywhere. It happened in China. It happened in Ukraine. And so what over time I learned to do was have a process to localizing the job title and description. Yeah. So what does that look like, right? The first thing that you have to do is go to a job board. So I think I'm hiring a sales development representative. So the first thing you have to do is go to a job board in that country and type sales development representative and see if anything comes up. If it doesn't, you're in trouble. You need a different job title. And now you need to get help because you need somebody in that market. It's not even someone that speaks the language. So this is not about translation. Don't get your Polish friend in Toronto to help you solve the problem you have in Warsaw. People that are in the market, that understand, that are seeing these requisitions every day, that are seeing job profiles every day, understand how you need to describe such a position and also understand what the title should be. And those demands can be different in every market. So the first and most important thing, very often when we do something like this in Ukraine, so if we were saying we were looking for sales development manager, or rather sales development representative, we might put like sales assistant or intern. I mean, I'm serious. You know, that you would put something, and it's just you have to find even a word, because you can always translate the job description, but I don't know how many times you've done like a Google Translate from, I don't know, it's probably pretty good between German and English, but if you do, you know, kind of from English to Chinese and then from Chinese back to English, and you see kind of, you know, what the telephone game spits out, you can't even translate it two ways between many languages. So it's really important. It's really, 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 really important. And markets have different requirements on job descriptions also. So if we take like a market like China, you should be really quite specific in your requirements. Same kind of situation in Ukraine. So very detailed requirements. In a market like Poland, which has like the lowest unemployment in Europe. Happy days, Poland. Lowest unemployment in Europe. Yeah, right. So your job description is going to be very short because you're basically making a Google ad. You're basically Google advertising. This is a Google ad. Please click here. Please come to my site and read the rest. Of course, companies don't always do that, right? But the right model there, at least at the initial stage of recruitment, is to put just enough description so that somebody applies for the job. Because so few people apply for the job, if you put too much description, you scare them away. So it's really like this, a different situation in every market. And the only way to really do these markets right is to have a resource there, have someone there that knows the market and that is able to localize, not translate, and give feedback about your job offer. Otherwise it just hire people locally, even if you can't. So yeah, you're in trouble. You won't get the best people.
It's so interesting how important the cultural element is in recruitment. Because I'm just thinking, like, even now here in Germany, we're having this conversation about, you know, inclusive language and job descriptions to make sure that it appeals to really like a broad range of people. But you're totally right about like the details even included in the job ad, you know, like too much will maybe cause some people not to apply. And also on the other end of the spectrum, too little, and people don't know if it's a job for them as well. What would be like your biggest takeaway from, you know, kind of collecting these learnings over the year? Like, what's your best advice that you can give to other people in business from that kind of interesting cross-cultural perspective? And obviously, it's all about communication.
It's all about communication. It's all about communicating with people in the language and in the location where they're ready to engage with you as a brand, as a company, as an employer brand. Because when talent is so scarce, you can't take the risk that you say, okay, well, we appreciate that you're trying to engage with us on Instagram, for example, but actually we just want you to go to our job site and apply. we're not going to have a conversation with you here. And this employer branding and communication in the recruitment process or the recruitment experience that a candidate has when they're being recruited in the company was something that companies were thinking about. They were thinking about this before 2019. So this isn't something new, but now companies must adapt. And they've had to over the last year and a half. They have to really adapt that process to a global one. And I think this is really a challenge, right? How do you do 5 markets in 5 different languages? Because the pre-screening, you know, your job description should definitely not be in English unless English is the national language of that country. Job description needs to be in the local language. The first person that engages with the candidate needs to speak the local language. It should not be a recruiter in New York if you are hiring in Berlin. Should be somebody in Germany speaking German or somewhere nearby. And I think that these are the things that are missing a little bit, right? What we see is that companies just put a remote checkbox. And I challenge companies not to check the remote checkbox. I understand that it goes completely against the idea that you might be hiring remotely. It's fine, but actually decide where you're hiring remotely. And then just post local jobs in those countries. And you can write that it's remote, but posting these global advertisements that you're hiring for a remote job just generates a lot of non-targeted applicants. And I think that the reason that companies do this, they just don't know where to start. But that also creates a negative experience for the candidate because you've got people from all over the world that are applying to your position. You've got a lot of candidate volume that you have to sort through. And a lot of those people are going to be declined, right? Only one person will get the job at the end of the day. To kind of spread that around planet Earth. So instead of just locally, you know, within 50 miles or 100 kilometers saying, okay, all right, so we searched and it didn't work out, sorry, or we had an interview and it's okay. It's very, very much a local reputation of your brand or a regional reputation of your brand. But when you start having these interactions, as a brand in a country where you might not be present physically today, but you might be in the future, you really need to think about this can be some of your first communication with that market. It's really the beginning of your, you know, it's your market entry. These are the first conversations that you're having with potential future business partners, employees, customers, even though you're just doing a hiring process. And I think you really have to be conscious of that. That you don't seem like, I don't know, you don't seem like a new Roman. that's, you know, well, we are here and we speak English and we posted remote on our job. So we call you and we speak English and this is how it's going to be because we have to check in the process. It makes people uncomfortable. You know, the opportunity here is like this. A billion knowledge workers, mostly everybody worked from home for the last 18 months. But most of those people, they're going to go back to their local job, right? Where they work in Berlin or Warsaw or London or wherever, they are going back to their normal job. Maybe not going back to the office, but they're going to work in that normal job, which was their local within 100 kilometers, whatever. The opportunity here is to take those people. This is the opportunity that we're peddling here to actually go into markets where talent is available or would be more open to change than other markets to offer the same compensation and benefits or better compensation, but same level of benefits that they have that they could expect from a local employer. So they're comparing apples and apples when they're making that decision. They're not thinking like, oh, I'm going to go be a freelancer on Upwork and maybe I won't get paid or maybe my salary will change after a month or something like this. They're thinking like, I have the same level of job security as I do working for a major national employer as I do working for this company, which can be a multinational or can be a startup that is in another part of the world because I have my full-time salary, benefits, all these kind of things. You know, maybe they're not always so sexy to startup founders. They're thinking, we'll just figure it out. You're engineering in another country, or you're a business development person in another country, and we'll put you as a contractor. It's so easy to hire everybody like that, but not everybody wants to be hired like that. And I think that's the challenge here. It's actually to have parity, because otherwise you look a bit silly when, you know, you're trying to pull somebody out of a company that has all of these things and you don't offer them. So you won't win. There's no reason.
So it seems like in order for companies to win the war for talent, they need to have the right communications in place and they need local knowledge. And it doesn't seem that many companies have made that connection yet. And as you say, they're trying to do this with a shotgun approach and see what sticks. But that's certainly not the most targeted, most efficient and fastest way to win this war.
It's not. I think that the playbook is there. The same rules apply. The challenge for leaders is how to take that playbook that we were using a couple of years ago. It's not so old, which is focused on outbound search, not inbound applicants. This is number one, right? This is how companies always find the best people. This is why recruiters exist. Otherwise, we'd just have careers pages on our websites and everybody would apply and we would have exactly who we wanted and everything would be great. Outbound search is the best way to find the best talent. And this is not a new concept or a new idea. But this challenge, this problem of how do you do outbound search when you're hiring anywhere, this is a challenge now, a new challenge for companies. And there are service providers, there are companies that you can go to that will try to do this. But really what they do is they're sitting in one location. And they're doing the same thing you would do in your office, right? They're sitting in one location, they're going on LinkedIn, and they're looking for people. You can do the same thing. So if that's the strategy, get yourself a LinkedIn account. You probably already have one if you're an employer, and start searching anywhere. Great. You can do it yourself. But this doesn't address the cultural issues, right? This doesn't address the language issues. This doesn't address... You'll get people that are just like, there's somebody writing me from, you know, New York, and I'm in another city in the world. That's like uncomfortable. Even though we live in this global village where everybody's your neighbor, it's still not super comfortable when someone writes you from a very far away place and proposes you work.
I think we can see that. It's interesting. I think the challenge is clear, but also the solution is now clear. And what it takes, that mental step to appreciate that, proper communication as well as localized knowledge is super important. Before we wrap up, as a final question, I would love to have sort of key learning from you in terms of communications, maybe related to running businesses on three continents, because that gives you a very unique perspective.
My experience in each country has been very different. I think that a really great example of that is when I first arrived in Poland to be the managing director of a company here in Poland. It was a company that I had invested in, but not a company that I was running. And I came in 2017 to run the business as the CEO. And after maybe 2 weeks, the HR business partner organized a meeting with me. And he said, "Jonathan, I understand that you've just moved from China. And I know that you were working before in Ukraine. But now we are in Poland. And you have to tone it down a little bit. You're really, really strict. You're really, really, you're like, this is not a military dictatorship. You're really, really try to think about like back when you were in California, how you did that, and maybe do that a little bit better in Poland. Don't do what you were doing in China. Don't do what you were doing in Ukraine." And the funny thing is, like, I could not be further from it really surprised me. It really, really surprised me. I'm someone who expects results, but my door is always open, and I'm always soliciting the feedback from the team before taking decisions. So I was really surprised. I was really surprised that these are, you're really very strict with people, and your expectations are, you know, they're like a military, they're military style. And I thought, okay, well, that just can't be right. But this speaks to how people are different in every market. Like, look, the world is a really big place. It's a really big place. I mean, I visited something like, I don't know, 60 or 70 countries. I stopped counting because I haven't gone virtually anywhere in the last 18 months. But you know, I've been in so many countries and seen so many cultures and had a chance to engage with business leaders in all of those countries and all those places. And yes, it is true that communication across cultural lines is a challenge, particularly coming from, you know, really open environment like California, like the Bay Area, like the US. I remember when I first arrived in Ukraine that it was really strange that I didn't wear a suit, that I wasn't wearing like a suit to the office, or that I thought that it was okay to work in the open space with the team, because my office was one floor up and in a corner somewhere, and I should wear a suit and I should go sit in that office, and people should only come to me when they are being fired or something. I don't know. It should be like a terrifying thing to come to my office, and I should go and, you know, walk the floor. And they're very, very different experience there. Of course, this is also a country. Ukraine is a country that is changing all the time. That has changed also so much since, you know, in less than a decade, has changed so much, and the expectations of employees have also changed, and the way to manage them, over the course of a decade, has changed dramatically. I think that it's much closer to that kind of open environment in Poland. You know, I wanted to do this when I arrived in Ukraine, and I stood there also with HR and said, yep, okay, so, you know, here I am, and I believe in a flat organization, and yeah, I understand there are like 400 of you, but anyway, we're going to work it out. Somehow this will be flat. And the HR person that was translating at the time stopped me and was like, I'm not going to translate that. No one is going to understand what you're talking about. So we're not going to translate that. That's good that you think you're going to do that. It's not going to happen. And so, you know, fortunately, I've had in every single one of these markets, I've given you two examples here. In both markets, there was a local experienced HR leader that came to me and said, hey, the style needs to shift for this market. Hi, that management structure that you proposed, it's not happening here. And of course, maybe that was the company, maybe that was the team. You know, everyone is a butterfly and a snowflake and unique and whatever, in the sense that whatever happened to me might not happen to you. And it could be a totally unique experience and not related to the market. But I think what is a common thread for me in all of those cases was that I had somebody that understood the market, that said to me, hey, that's not going to work, or let's try this in a different way. And I think that's what's really missing from this process right now, with the idea of let's hire people everywhere. It's that person to say, hey, that's not going to work. You need to change something here if you want this to be successful.
Definitely agree with that. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Jonathan. It's been super insightful and very interesting to learn a little bit more about the inner workings of how to truly make remote working work. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Nicole.